History is made.
Good evening, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free, KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is also syndicated on WHYR 96.9 FM in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. If you did not tune in last week and haven't heard yet, this is the new time slot for Arab Voices radio talk show. We are now on Wednesdays, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Central Time. Border Radio with Susan, that used to air at 6 p.m. Central, has a new expanded time slot, and that's on Thursdays, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Today on the show, our guest will be David Vine, Associate Professor of Anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C. He is the author of Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World. He is also author of Island of Shame, the secret history of the U.S. military base on Diego Garcia. We will speak with him live about his books, the U.S. foreign policy and military policy towards the world, U.S. military bases around the globe, including the Middle East, involvements with war, and more. We will be taking your questions live. The number is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. But first, let's start with Arab Voices Community Calendar. The Syrian American Club in Houston is offering a scholarship program for qualified students in the community for the 2017-2018 academic year. Students who graduated from high school this year and plan to attend college are encouraged to apply. Students who are undergraduates in a four-year college program may also apply if they are in their junior year or below. A limited number of scholarships will be awarded to those with the highest qualifications and or greatest need. More information about this scholarship is posted on our website, arabvoices.net. And by the way, the deadline to apply is August 28. The Arab American Cultural and Community Center will resume its Saturday Arabic classes in September. There will be a meeting with the teachers as well as registration on September 9th. There will be Arabic classes for youth and adults. To learn more about the school and to register, call 832-351-3366 or send email to school@acchouston.org. The Syrian American Club in Houston is also resuming its Arabic classes for this school year. The fall semester for Arabic school will begin on Saturday, August 26th. If you have any questions or for more information, send email to SyrianAmericanClub@yahoo.com. St. Francis Cabrini Center for Immigrant Legal Assistance will hold a free citizenship workshop this weekend. It will be held at the Arab American Cultural and Community Center on 10555 Stancliffe Road. It will be at 2 p.m. on Saturday, August 26. Eligible applicants will work with volunteers to start the citizenship application process. More details about this event is on our website, arabvoices.net. Eid al-Adha, or Sacrifice Feast, is expected to be Friday, September 1st. That's next week. A few Eid celebrations and events have been scheduled in the greater Houston area. There will be Eid al-Adha Carnival at Mass Katy Center on 1800 Baker Road on Saturday, September 2nd, from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. There will be Eid al-Adha brunch on Sunday, September 3rd, organized by the American Druze Society. And on September 12th, a special women's interfaith Eid celebration and dinner will be held. It will be an evening for women of all faith backgrounds to explore Islam and celebrate the contributions of Muslim women around the world and in Houston. It is organized by the Houston Pink Iftar, the Women's Interfaith Table of Houston, and the Heinz Center for Spirituality and Prayer. Opening remarks will be by Wafa Abdeen, Vice President of Immigration and Refugee Services at Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Galveston, Houston. This event will be held on Tuesday, September 12th at 6 p.m. at the Reynolds Hall at Christ Church Cathedral on 1117 Texas Avenue. More information about all of those Eid events is on our website, arabvoices.net. The Syrian American Club will hold an event of Arabic poetry and anecdotes with Dr. Mu'tasim Basha on Sunday, September 10th at 3:30 p.m. at Asham Center in Houston. If you are interested in attending, please send email to SyrianAmericanClub@yahoo.com. There are several other events scheduled in the greater Houston area. For a comprehensive list of all of those events, visit our website, and that's arabvoices.net. We will take a break now, and when we come back, we will speak live with David Vine, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the American University in Washington, D.C. He is author of Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World, and also author of Island of Shame, The Secret History of U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia. We will speak with him about his books, about the U.S. foreign policy and military bases around the globe and in the Middle East, and U.S. involvements with wars and more. We will be taking your questions live. The number is 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free, KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is also syndicated on WHYR 96.9 FM in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Joining us now live via phone from Washington, D.C. is David Vine. He is associate professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C. He is the author of Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World. He is also author of Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, The Guardian, Mother Jones, Boston Globe, Huffington Post, The Chronicle of Higher Education, just to name a few. He is also author or co-author of The Counterinsurgency Manual, or Notes on Demilitarizing American Society, with the Network for Concerned Anthropologists. David is a contributor to TomDispatch.com and Foreign Policy in Focus. David, welcome to Arab Voices.
It's really a pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks. We greatly appreciate your time this evening. So much to talk about, especially these days under the new administration in the White House. I would like to get your feedback first about a couple of days ago, President Trump announced that he is planning to escalate or increase the troops in Afghanistan, despite, just if I recall correctly, 2 weeks ago or so, he was talking about why do we need to send more troops, why do we have military all over the world. During the campaign for the presidency, one of his lines were that we shouldn't be policing the world, we shouldn't be everywhere, why should we defend Germany, and this and that. What's your take on his recent talk about Afghanistan?
It's true, there's quite a shift from some of his talk during the campaign that in some ways, surprisingly to many, given the horrific nature of many of his other comments, when it came to foreign policy, there was at least some indication that he was interested in pursuing less interventionist, less interventionist foreign policy abroad. Many of the details remain to be seen in terms of what he announced the other day, but it sounds like more of the same. It sounds like a relatively small number of troops, and as other analysts have pointed out, it's unclear why anyone thinks that there'll be a different result, given that, you know, with far more troops in previous years, the U.S. military was unable to bring anything like peace to Afghanistan. So it really does seem like much the same. And sadly, the Obama administration pursued much the same policy, but at least had some measure of diplomatic efforts underway. Of course, not nearly what one would hope, but the Trump administration is really, to this point, hollowed out the diplomatic core of the State Department, and from most appearances, is not pursuing much of anything of a diplomatic solution that really is the only possible solution. This is just doubling down, tripling down after, you know, more in the longest war in U.S. history on a failed military strategy. So I'm quite distressed, as many are.
And so obviously sending more military personnel and more armament to Afghanistan, that is not going to help whatever cause the so-called war on terror the U.S. is after. It's not going to do the job for the U.S. administration.
It certainly doesn't seem like it will achieve much of anything. And I think, you know, what we should be most concerned about are, the people of Afghanistan who have suffered now decades of war, long before the U.S. invaded in October 2001, of course, war going back to effectively 1979 and the Soviet invasion, if not earlier. And again, I think, you know, that, you know, with decades of evidence that military solutions are not going to bring peace to Afghanistan, that there has to be diplomatic negotiation involving many parties, of course, multiple parties in Afghanistan, but also other regional powers, India, Pakistan, Iran, Russia, among them. So it's not a good moment for diplomacy, but hopefully we will hear increasing chorus of voices criticizing this. It just feels like a sort of Groundhog Day of the same policy all over again.
Now, obviously, Afghanistan is one stop in the United States' history of military bases and military presence throughout the world. You are an expert on that. You have written about this extensively. And one of the book that you authored that's titled Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World. So tell us more first a little bit in general about the book that you authored. And I think paperback is coming in a couple of months or so. Tell us more about that, and then we'll dive into those military bases that are literally around the globe.
Sure. Yeah, you're right that the paperback version of Base Nation is coming out in October, which I'm excited about, and it's in several other languages in addition to the original in English, of course. But basically, the book looks at the global network of U.S. military bases in other lands, in other countries, on other people's soil. This was something that I, like most people in the United States, thought little, if anything, about for most of my life until I began studying the issue now about 16 years ago. Most of us in the United States are completely unaware that the United States today possesses approximately 800 military bases in other countries, 800 bases outside the 50 states and Washington, D.C. And most are unaware of the numbers, and more importantly, are of course, the effects of these bases. For decades during the Cold War, many argued that the United States had to maintain hundreds of bases and hundreds of thousands of troops outside the United States to ensure its security and its own peace and global peace in the conflict with the Soviet Union. And that's the history of most of these bases. Most of them date back to the end of World War II, to bases occupied in Germany, Japan, Italy, and later in South Korea during the Korean War. This is very much a Cold War era policy that the United States has been pursuing. And while there were some base closures after the end of the Cold War, the basic infrastructure and global structure of bases around the world remained much the same. And effectively, the United States has been pursuing the same military strategy despite the absence of any superpower enemy. Of course, some have tried to portray Russia and China as superpower-like threats or grave threats to the United States in recent years, but they are nothing like the threat that the Soviet Union posed during the Cold War. So in effect, the United States has been pursuing this Cold War-era policy for now decades after the end of the Cold War, and few people have asked whether these bases are indeed protecting the United States. Are there better ways the United States could be protected? And what other effects these bases are having, the effects on local people who live around them, the environmental effects, the effects on democracy. One of the other claims about this global base network and bases, U.S. bases abroad, it has long been that U.S. bases spread democracy. There might be some evidence to show that perhaps in Germany and Japan right after World War II that the U.S. bases played a stabilizing presence and helped bring some measure of democracy gradually to both countries. But what we see today is the United States is maintaining its bases in at least 30 countries that are undemocratic. They're run by undemocratic regimes, dictators in some cases. repressive regimes. So U.S. bases in those cases are de facto propping up undemocratic regimes and often blocking the spread of democracy by blocking any momentum pro-democracy groups in those countries might develop. So we see those kinds of effects. And I think it's especially critical to look at the ways in light of the growing and really truly frightening tensions in Korea and with North Korea, the role that U.S. bases have frequently played in increasing military tensions and ramping up a process of militarization. The United States has literally hundreds of bases in East Asia, beginning with South Korea and Japan, but elsewhere as well. These bases are in the case of North Korea, right at near their border. In the case of China and Russia, we effectively encircle these two other powers. And I think it's worth people in the United States asking and considering how we would feel if China or Russia or North Korea or Iran were to have even a single base anywhere near the borders of the United States. I think we would, you know, in Mexico and the Caribbean, we would see very quickly U.S. citizens, politicians calling for a major increase in U.S. military spending and a buildup of U.S. military forces and some sort of reaction. You can imagine that China, Russia, North Korea, and other countries feel rightfully threatened by the presence, this really massive presence of U.S. bases and forces quite close to their borders. And indeed, these bases are meant to threaten. That is one of their central aims. So the book, Base Nation, really tries to look at carefully at the global effects this network of approximately 800 bases is having, and to begin to ask questions that too few people have been asking. For example, the question of, you know, are these bases indeed protecting us? Are they bringing peace and security to the globe? And importantly, what could we be doing with the money being spent on these bases, which in the book I estimate the cost of maintaining bases and troops abroad is upwards of $100 billion a year. That's billion with a B, and that's a larger budget than the entire budget of the State Department. And effectively, again, we are pursuing an outdated Cold War era policy, and in the process wasting literally billions of dollars that could be better spent protecting the United States here at home or in pursuing diplomatic efforts abroad.
And of course we want to talk more about the effect and the cost and all that stuff. But if for me and for my our listeners to comprehend 800 military bases in so many countries around the world, I mean, what is the justification? So they started after World War II, like, and even in any single country, there are so many of them, in Germany, in Japan. So is it to protect the U.S., like to intervene if somebody's trying to attack the U.S. from that part of the world? Is it to protect the regimes and those countries? What is the exact justification for having so many military bases in those countries?
Yeah, this is an unprecedented collection of bases in world history, more bases than any nation, country, or empire in world history. And the United States has had bases abroad since its independence. It's important to remember that bases on Native American lands outside the 13 original colonies and states were, of course, very much abroad and enabled the expansion and conquest of the United States across North America, and of course the deaths of millions of Native American peoples. So bases have played a critical and often overlooked role in expanding the territory of the United States and the power of the United States over other countries. After the conquest across North America, the country began acquiring a small number of bases outside of North America, mostly on islands like those conquered during the Spanish-American War of 1898, in the Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico, and Guantanamo Bay, base that probably the most well-known base abroad. And during World War II that the United States' collection of bases overseas expanded exponentially, and that's when the United States built up this what became a permanent network of bases abroad. The justification, there are many justifications offered, including some I mentioned, the deterring enemies, spreading democracy, bringing peace and security.
Spreading democracy by the United States?
Indeed. But I think we should be very careful in analyzing any justification offered and demanding evidence. And that's one of the other things I point to in Base Nation, that for literally decades, since the early in the Cold War, people have just assumed as almost a matter of religious belief that the United States must maintain these bases abroad and hundreds of thousands of troops on them to ensure its security. But rarely did anyone ask for demand some evidence that these bases were indeed ensuring the security of the United States. And I am happy to say that recently there are people across the political spectrum, a growing number of people across the political spectrum, who are beginning to question this collection of bases and again to ask, are there other ways and better ways to protect our security, to protect and bring peace to the world? So you see Republicans, libertarians, people on the left beginning to ask these sorts of questions, especially in an era where the U.S. Navy, for all its problems that have been highlighted in recent days, and the U.S. Air Force can transport and deploy U.S. military power extraordinarily rapidly around the globe. So there have been studies, including by the RAND Corporation, nothing close to a leftist outlet, government-funded and closely linked to the government, that has shown that bases in the United States, domestic bases, can deploy U.S. forces almost as fast or just as fast as bases, almost every base overseas. And any benefit in terms of speed that a base overseas might provide in terms of deployment speed is not, as they concluded, not worth the extraordinary cost that these bases inflict on the United States. Some people, just to mention a little bit more about the cost, some are aware that some countries have in the past and still to this day pay some of the costs of U.S. military basing in their countries. So Japan, for example, South Korea. There are very few countries that still pay some of those costs. A few, Italy and Germany, pay some in-kind or make some in-kind contributions but don't provide any direct cash. But even in cases where countries provide cash, like Japan, the cost of keeping troops and bases in those countries is dramatically more expensive in almost every case compared to maintaining a base in the United States itself.
This is astonishing. More than $100 billion, you mentioned that it costs the United States annually to maintain those bases throughout the world. And you mentioned that one of their, I don't know if it's a goal or what, is to spread democracy, but yet those regimes and the people who are in power in those countries, most of them are dictators, and they do not practice nor do they spread democracy in their own country. So as if those military bases are there to protect and keep those puppets, sometimes they are referred to, of the United States government, to stay in power and keep their country stable from their viewpoint, so they support the U.S. The U.S. will support them and keep them in power there.
Indeed, and you know, Bahrain, of course, is a dramatic example of this, where the U.S. Navy maintains headquarters for its Fifth Fleet and has for years now, a country where, with the help of Saudi Arabia, of course, pro-democracy demonstrators have been cracked down on brutally by the Bahraini government and with the implicit support of the United States. You know, the Obama administration offered some very cautious and light criticism of the Bahraini government during the Arab Spring and in years after, as they were cracking down on pro-democracy demonstrators. But there was no desire to risk this massive headquarters that the Navy has built, and to the tune of billions of dollars invested, certainly, by this point. But that's just one example. There are U.S. bases throughout the Persian Gulf. There are U.S. bases in every Persian Gulf country except Iran and I believe Yemen, although there are likely some sort of U.S. military presence back in Yemen now. And all of those countries are run by undemocratic regimes of one kind or another. But the list goes on with examples that spread from Africa to Asia, where the United States is again supporting undemocratic rulers of one kind or another.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting with all these military bases around the globe, and I read it, I forgot of when, either in your book or one of the articles you published. You mentioned we have 800 military bases around the globe, or maybe even plus. And I wanted to ask you also another question, whether there are any secret military bases, or referred to as something different, military installations, secret around the world. There are some talks about that. Yet when you look at other countries and their military bases around the globe, of course, I don't think there is any military base in the U.S. for any other country, they total around 30 or so for all countries in the world, only 30, yet the U.S. alone has 800-plus military bases.
Indeed, there are some foreign militaries that have a presence in the United States to arrange training exercises where foreign military forces will come visit the United States, but there are no U.S. there are no foreign bases in the United States. This was pointed out quite dramatically by President Rafael Correa of Ecuador a few years back, when the lease on a U.S. base in Manta, Ecuador, was coming up, and he said he would renew the lease on the base, but only on one condition. And that was that the United States allow Ecuador to build a base in Miami. And, you know, I think almost everyone in the United States can't contemplate a foreign base on our soil, whereas people tend to treat it as natural that the United States maintain hundreds of bases abroad. I should say that the number, the 800 number, is an estimate, and I put together a spreadsheet detailing the bases I've been able to enumerate, and it's available on the website for Base Nation, and the website address is basenation.us. That's basenation.us. So people can take a look at the spreadsheet and also take a look at the 16 maps that are in Base Nation that depict and try to depict this global network of bases, its history, and its current effects. But the number, the 800 number, comes from a Pentagon count that the Pentagon puts together periodically. The latest count that I've seen that I used for the spreadsheet showed that the U.S. has about 700 base sites, as they call them, outside the 50 states and Washington, D.C. And these range in size from city-sized bases, like those still seen in Germany and Japan, South Korea, with tens of thousands of troops and family members in many cases. They have schools and hospitals, movie theaters, bowling alleys, yoga studios, everything you'd
find
in
towns, fully equipped towns.
American city.
Yeah.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, they're quite small bases. But to get back to your question about secret bases, there evidence of secret bases are by their nature hard to identify, but they're certainly secret bases, and the base presence in, just for example, Syria and Iraq now is quite hard to pin down, because there are reports of secretive U.S. bases in both countries, just for example, but elsewhere as well around the world.
And some also, those secretive places, they are used to torture people from other countries or other places that they've captured.
Well, that has been hard to document and identify. So the reason that I came, and this is one example, the reason I came to start looking at U.S. bases abroad and their impacts was that I was introduced to the story of Diego Garcia, which is a small island in the middle of the Indian Ocean, halfway from between Africa and Australia and due south of India, very isolated. And the reason the United States has a base there is that in the late 1960s and early 1970s, with the help of the British government, which controls the island, the two governments forcibly removed the entire indigenous people of the island. They're called the Chagossians. And displaced them 1,200 miles away, dumped them almost literally on the docks, left them on the docks in Mauritius and the Seychelles in the western Indian Ocean. And Diego Garcia has grown into a massive base in the decades that have followed, one of the most significant for the U.S. Navy and U.S. Air Force in the world. And there were suspicions that it was used as a site during the George W. Bush administration after 9/11 to hold and torture suspected terrorists. Again, documenting that has been hard. That both governments, U.S. and British, denied that anyone was held there, and then had to admit years later that actually there were some accused terrorists rendered, as they like to call it, through Diego Garcia on the way to other countries. I think what's clearer is that the U.S. military has tended to outsource its torture to foreign militaries to be able to deny keep its hands clean, so to speak. I think where it's clearer that there has been torture going on is, of course, Guantanamo Bay and early in the first days of the global war on terror, and in Afghanistan at Bagram Air Base, but certainly there are strong suspicions that torture has taken place in many locations around the world.
Yeah, and that military base you mentioned, Diego Garcia, of course, you've written about that in the book Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base in Diego Garcia. And it has a very, very strategic location, as you mentioned, in the Indian Ocean, south of India. When I looked at it on the map, it's interesting, right there in the middle of so many different areas. Points. I want to remind the listeners of the phone number to call and ask questions of our guest. That number is 713-526-5738. You are listening to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of the show. Our guest this evening is David Vine, associate professor of anthropology at the American University in Washington, D.C. He is author of Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Around or Abroad Harm America and the World. Also author of Island of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base in Diego Garcia. 713-526-5738 is the phone number. I have so many other questions, but we already have callers on hold, so let's take a call from Maad. Maad, you're on the air.
Hey, Saeed. It seems like since manufacturing started moving manufacturing out to China in the early 70s when Nixon went on the behest of Pepsi, U.S.'s main export for the last, 16 years has been democracy, right? The question to your guest, why are there more CIA office installations in Afghanistan than there are U.S. military bases?
It was a little hard to hear, but if I heard the question correctly, why are there more
CIA offices in Afghanistan than military bases?
Ah, yeah, indeed, a good question. And part of what I discuss in Base Nation is that the CIA, since 9/11, and since the United States invaded Afghanistan in October 2001, the CIA has increasingly become a paramilitary organization. So many of its offices are increasingly looking like military bases of various kinds. I don't know what the status of the CIA presence in Afghanistan is compared to that of the U.S. military at this point. But I think what's important is that there is, of course, a significant CIA presence in Afghanistan. As far as I know, there's still a CIA presence in Pakistan. Pakistan has been used as a drone base. There are multiple locations where drones have been launched from Pakistan, and both the CIA and, of course, the military have been involved in controlling the drone program. But I think, again, whether which entity has a larger presence, what's important is that the CIA has increasingly become a paramilitary force that has been aggressively targeting, suspected terrorists, but in many cases, the evidence for is increasingly the standard of evidence for being targeted in the drone program is increasingly little. As some probably know, there's under the Obama administration, just fitting the profile of a terrorist, doing exercises, for example, calisthenics, could land someone on a list to be targeted.
And can I ask just another question? Why we see the fusion centers that were used in Vietnam during the Phoenix program, chronicled by several historians now, these are being considered now for the same purpose here in the States by Eric Prince of Blackwater, formerly known. And one more question. Up to 2005, Syria was one of the U.S.'s several outsourced remote torture countries. And so response to that, and I'll take it offline. Thank you.
Thank you for all these challenging and questions. I'm not sure I heard the second one fully. But the third, I think, was asking about the role of Syria in being a place where torture was outsourced.
Yes, before 2005, up to 2005.
Yeah, I think, of course, this is just another example of how the United States and U.S. military and United States government more broadly has gotten in bed, so to speak, with murderous regimes, has partnered with murderous regimes in the case of the torture program, frequently outsourced torture to regimes like that of Assad. The second question, I think, was asking about the Phoenix program during
Yes, and Blackwater, and he was referring to that. I didn't catch part of it also because the audio quality wasn't good from that call.
Okay. Well, maybe that caller, if he's interested, he could email me at I'd be happy to answer it by email. My email address is vine@american.edu, vine@american.edu, where I'll do my best to answer it. It may not be my area of expertise.
Okay, and of course, in Iraq, that war that we, the United States, launched on Iraq destroyed the country, brought it back hundreds of years behind, destroyed the infrastructure completely based on lies, and we have now military bases in Iraq big time as one of many countries. You mentioned some of them earlier in the Middle East, and we also have bases in Egypt and so on. Now, those military bases in the Middle East and throughout the globe, and as I read from your book, they are mainly built by contractors that the United States government hires to equip and facilitate or actually do those military bases and maintain them throughout the world. So how do you see this and a link to the military-industrial complex in arming and more armament and more weapons so some companies and corporations can benefit?
Yeah, this is a critical aspect of this huge network of bases. And you asked before about justifications. Justifications aside, one of the reasons that this huge network of bases has remained in place decades after the end of the Cold War, despite the absence of a superpower enemy like the Soviet Union, and the reason many bases remained open during the Cold War when their actual military utility was often quite questionable, is the literally billions of dollars that private corporations have made building and maintaining these bases. Going back to the late 1960s, early 1970s, the Senate investigated U.S. bases and troop presence abroad and found that once a base is established overseas, it becomes very difficult to close because, in for a variety of reasons, but certainly one of them, and increasingly, this is increasingly the case in the era since the outsourcing of military services, of military construction, military maintenance has only grown and grown dramatically. There are corporations that stand to lose hundreds of millions of dollars, in some cases billions of dollars, if a base is closed. So you see there are very powerful actors in whose interest it is to make sure these bases remain open. This is a very troubling dimension, and indeed is one component of the larger military-industrial complex.
How many troops are there in those 800 or so military bases around the world, approximately?
Yeah, I haven't seen the latest totals, but they're, I believe, somewhere around 200,000 U.S. troops.
Wow.
There are about 25,000 troops in South Korea now, some 30,000 in Japan, and a little bit more, I believe, in Germany, if I'm getting my numbers right. So that most troops are in those three countries, a large number also in Italy, and other troops are spread around the globe.
Now, what is the information that you've gathered from your research and extensive writing and following up this topic of U.S. military bases around the world from the people in those countries? Governments is a whole different game, and we talked about that already. But the actual people there, whether in the Middle East or other countries, and I know some people even they do attacks against the United States, and they, in their justification, quote unquote, they are opposed, and because of the, they call it U.S. occupation of some of their lands there. What are you hearing, and what information are you getting from the reaction of the people in these countries about those military bases?
It's a complicated picture, of course, although this was one of the central aims of my book, to look at, again, the impacts of U.S. bases on locals living around them and their perspectives, views, experiences with these bases. And there's, not surprisingly, a great deal of diversity when it comes to local people and their feelings and attitudes and thoughts about these bases. You have, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, quite vibrant opposition movements in many places. Okinawa is a very prominent example where Okinawans have been protesting for decades, literally, since the United States occupied Okinawa and ruled it. But especially in the last 22 years, since a very high-profile rape took place in 1995, and the United States has been seeking to build a new base in Okinawa, and Okinawans are saying that they have far too many bases already and are trying to block that construction. There are, of course, people in Okinawa and people around the world who benefit themselves from the presence of U.S. bases. They might work on the bases. There are local companies who get contracts to provide services or material for the bases in addition to U.S. corporations that benefit from their presence. There are, of course, people who run businesses that benefit, bars, restaurants, hotels. So there's, not surprisingly, some who are very supportive in countries around the world of the U.S.-based presence.
No.
To touch on real quickly, sorry, the issue, the very important issue you brought up, which is that bases, in particular in the Middle East, have been shown to inflame tensions frequently, and then to result in, or there's at least a correlation between the presence of U.S. bases and troops and recruitment by terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda. And we need only think back to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda's justification for the attacks of 9/11. One of the justifications was the presence of U.S. bases and troops in Saudi Arabia and on Muslim holy lands. And this is just one example of where U.S. bases directly undermine U.S. security by inflaming those who would violently oppose the presence of U.S. bases. A protest like that seen in Okinawa has always been peaceful, and people, they make a point of pointing out that it's not an anti-American sentiment that's driving their opposition. They're just opposed to the presence of U.S. bases and military forces on their land.
Yeah. We have about a minute left or so. That your book, Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World, it's just a wealth of information in it about military bases, an eye-opener big time. Unfortunately, it's not talked much about these military bases here in the United States, despite what you just mentioned, $150 or $100+ billion annually, despite the fact our schools and healthcare and so on here are in much, much need for that money. What can people do? What can be done to raise this issue more and to counter it?
Well, I have a list of resources and more information on my website for the book, basenation.us. There's a resources page, and that can connect people to organizations working on the issue, get more information. Again, I would point to the growing numbers of people across the political spectrum. Former Republican Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison from Texas wrote one of the blurbs for my book and said that while she doesn't come to all the same conclusions, she, like many, supports mine that there are better ways to protect the United States, and that bringing troops back to the United States to places like Texas would actually benefit local communities and rather than wasting billions as we are today.
Very well. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We're going to have to leave it at this. David Vine, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the American University in Washington, D.C., and author of Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World, has been our guest this evening. The website for his book and the information he gave us, as well as links to other resources, is basenation.us. Thank you, David, so much. We greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. I appreciate your inviting me.
Absolutely. Would love to have you again on the show. Thanks. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. Till the World is coming up next. And many thanks to Bob for his assistance tonight. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next Wednesday, peace on earth.
KPFT Houston helps celebrate Rice Radio's 25 years of specialty show Navrong with a free concert. Swar Yatra, a musical journey, on Sunday, September 10th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Rice University's Grand Hall. Doors open at 4 p.m. with early patrons enjoying free henna tattoos, fruits, drinks, and tea. Stay late for a meet and greet and free authentic Indian vegetarian cuisine. Access free parking at West Lot 2 with code KTRU. Concert features Indian fusion, classical instrumental, and classical vocal. More information available at ktru.org. This is KPFT Houston.
Many companies will match gifts made to nonprofit organizations. A matching gift from your company will help KPFT preserve independent music, arts, news, and views for generations to enjoy. Just make a gift to KPFT this hour at kpft.org. Then contact your human resources office for eligibility requirements and to obtain a matching gift form. Many companies match the gifts of retirees, spouses, and surviving spouses, too. just fill out the employee portion of the form completely and send the form to KPFT, Attention Matching Gifts, 419 Levitt Boulevard, Houston, Texas, 77006. Your gift to KPFT could double if your company has a matching gift program. Your help makes a difference. This is 90.1 KPF Gift Program. Your help makes a difference. This is 90.1 KPF.